all those who loved her be glad, all those who were mourning over her, in order to suck to full satisfaction from the teat of her compassion, and to suck of the milk of exquisite delight from the teat of her glory. One of the most beautiful passages in all of Scripture, perhaps, Isaiah 66, verse 11. And we can also read the New World Translation, 1984, reference version, for the reason that you will suck and certainly get satisfaction from the breast of full consolation by her, for the reason that you will sip and experience exquisite delight from the teat of her glory. Just to show you that there are other translations that are quite similar. Now let's see, let's go down to Isaiah 66:11 of the American Standard Version, that ye may suck and be satisfied with the breasts of her consolations, that ye may milk out and be delighted with the abundance of her glory. Just for comparison, but it's such a poetic and beautiful, it's natural idea of a suckling child with his mother, and Jerusalem is the mother, the city of Jerusalem. Map of ancient Shinar. We're continuing now with our study of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express. Little children, we had the Ward Green version from 2003 for the Isaiah scripture. This is a wonderful map, I think, from somewhere on Wikimedia, the image site of Wikipedia, or the media site of Wikipedia. But Sumer, Akkad, and Elam is the title of this map, and it's beautiful. I believe the water here is shown, and I believe it's showing the extrapolation of the time before the deluge, when the water was actually more water here. It's what I think it's showing. The Gulf of, well, the Persian Gulf here is nowadays somewhere down here, I think. I'm not sure how exactly where it is, but I mean somewhere much further from these cities than it is shown here. And Elam would be nowadays, of course, extending much further south than is shown here, but Eridu is almost a coastal city in this map, as is Ur. And look where Abraham lived. It shows that Eridu and Ur, Abraham lived in Ur when he was younger with his father and his family. And Ur is a coastal city very close to Eridu. Eridu is said to be one of the oldest cities on earth. As it says here, we're going to read here. Or where is it? No, it's on the map. It's on the map. It says that, maybe it's not on the map. Where did I just read that? I just read it somewhere. That Eridu was 5400 BC. But this talks about the Sumerian king list before the deluge. There is a list of kings before the deluge on the Sumerian king list. So, I mean, it's just something you would love to have. Wouldn't you love to have just all the time that you would want, just so you could just peruse this? You know, what's the word? Browse is the word, I guess. Browse through all the ancient records of history and just meditate on all of the import, what it means, and it's so exquisite, I guess. It's better than it's just more than wonderful. It's just such a good thing to have the time to sort through these ancient records and acquire knowledge of our ancient brethren, our family history, so to speak, is not the name of Kainam, K-A-I-N-A-M, in brackets Kainan, C-A-I-N-A-N, end bracket. The origin of the words kin, king, two words K-I-N and K-I-N-G in English, and of Kim, K-I-M, capital K, in Korean. 0659 hours, I wrote. This is all part of, ever since the part is not the name of Kainam. That was the beginning of paragraph 7-6 of the article, The Ark of Urartu. Then I wrote 0659 hours. In historical Korean writing, scholars know every word is written in Chinese characters, called Hanja or Hangul, in Korea, but that originated in Chinese. The same Hanzi of China and Kanji of Japan, 0705 hours. All such are writing created by Kanji or Kainan, or Kangji, I think is the proper way of spelling his name. I think I forgot the G there. I might make a note. 0714 hours, I wrote, although kings did not rule over Jehovah's people until King Saul of Israel, Shinar had rulers much earlier. As we've been studying, right? We've been studying such kings as Thoth, Nimrod, Menes, Evacharus, all these different kings, whom some of whom might be the same king, in fact. But Shinar had rulers much earlier, even this land that later became called Shinar after the deluge. It even had rulers prior to the deluge, which is so mind-boggling to try and imagine what happened as a consequence that changed the geography as a result of the deluge. You know, what would have resulted from it? It's actually possible, I think, that what we see in this map is accurate, that there was more water there before the deluge, and after the deluge, when the waters drained off the land rose up again, right? After the weight of the water came off of it. But for whatever reason, you know, the landscape changed for probably in a variety of ways. After the deluge, there may have been tectonic activity or volcanic activity. A lot of things after the deluge may have been quite different. And this idea of there having been more water prior to the deluge in this area of Shinar or Mesopotamia, as it's also called, which is between the two rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris, which is all the area of Iraq, I believe Baghdad is there, and so on, in that vicinity of Babylon. Babylon is on the map here. You see Babylon right there? Very important that we note that. That became later the seat of the government of Nebuchadnezzar and the Chaldean people, ruled by him. But Eridu is quite a bit further south here, you see. Now, if you look on a normal map of today, I think you see that Eridu and Babylon are both quite a distance away from the Persian Gulf, whereas here the water is quite nigh here. Where can we get a map of that? Let's see if we can get a map. Let's go back to Wikipedia here and search for Persian Gulf, or maybe we can just get Eridu. Maybe they'll give us a map. Yeah, there you see. There's the Persian Gulf. Eridu is right here. We don't see it there. I'll just use this map. Here's Eridu. It's quite a ways from the water there. Quite a few miles. Based on the scale of the map we just looked at. Excuse me, I went the wrong way in my tabs. Okay, so look at the scale here. Let's see, what's on the extreme left of this map? Well, Babylon, okay. But where the two rivers come together, right here, you see? The Tigris and Euphrates approach each other at their nearest approach, right there. That we can identify on both maps. That can help us identify the scale. So there's where they approach the closest, right there. So Eridu's halfway between the closest approach of the rivers and the Persian Gulf. It's just about halfway, very close to half. Now if we look on the map we just were examining, there's the closest approach, there's Eridu. So the Persian Gulf is somewhere down here in the lower right corner of this map. It's just, there's a lot of water in addition shown above and to the left of the water of the present day. And it's about a distance. Eridu is about 125 miles today from the Persian Gulf, estimating. And it's right on the Gulf. So 125 miles more water is what this map shows before the deluge than there was after the deluge, or than there is today, rather. There it is. It's in the paragraph. So it says, one of five cities from before the deluge, Eridu is said to be the oldest city and founded 5400 BCE. That's when Eridu is believed to have been founded. So we didn't have to alter our chronology to account for the oldest city on Earth, because Adam was created in 5550 in our chronology, and 5400 BCE is 150 years after the creation of Adam. Although there wouldn't have been any children yet to build that city, so the date is only an approximate date, and probably significantly early. Right. Well, I mean, unless of course Adam himself built the city. Maybe he began the building of the city. It makes you think, when you have the time to meditate on the Bible and on the ancient history associated with the Bible, it's such a, which is all of history, essentially. It really is, because the Bible is the only history that goes back as far as it does to the first man. And perhaps, of course, we see a lot of the same things that are in the Bible that are also in the Quran. That's true. The Quran has many of the same teachings as the Old Testament does, and they believe that Jesus will return a second time too. In the Islamic faith, that's true. So they have some things in common there. Yeah, but there are differences too, which we today perhaps won't go into. The Sumerian account of silver for the governor, this clay tablet in a picture shown here, an illustration, a photograph from a museum object, an object that was found in Sumeria. It's a clay tablet with all these imprints of lines and triangles. The little triangles were used in many places in these imprints, sometimes at the end of a line, with the point of the triangle being continued by the line. And that was very, very common sort of feature of this kind of writing on these cuneiform tablets. There were also horizontal and vertical dividing lines here on this tablet, which didn't line up with each other. So not every vertical line continued all the way down, although the horizontal lines did continue all the way across. That's true. In this particular drawing, there's some horizontal ladder-like symbols, and we have some vertical patterns of horizontal lines, which are relatively short, in the middle of which is a vertical line with an inverted triangle at the top, or the flat part of the triangle at the top. That's something we see there. We have a symbol like pi here, somewhat, with two vertical lines and then a horizontal line on top. And another one like it below it, but it has the top line extended to the left. Some interesting characters there. For anyone who is studying Sumerian language, one of the earliest languages of all. Okay, we're really done. We've used 15 minutes. We're done. Yeah, guess what? I have some news about Raleigh. She stopped again, so Raleigh is put back where she belongs in the useless pile, or in the case where she belongs with the other watches, which some of which work and some of which, or one of which other watches doesn't work. Willie doesn't work anymore. I think that was the other one. That was a Chinese movement, I think, as well. But yeah, that's right. It was a seagull movement in Raleigh. And so it's just one of those unknowns. I could buy a new movement for maybe $30 or something, but it's still an unknown as to whether it would ever work. And then I'd have to replace the movement, install it in the watch, which is not, you know, or I could just buy a new watch, which would be $100 and some. I have to find out how to fix it, really, because otherwise I could buy another watch, but it might have the same problem in the future. I don't see that as a, even though I love the watch, it doesn't work. I can't see that as a productive solution to just buy another watch of the same manufacturer. So I don't want to do that. It just doesn't make sense to me, right? You buy a watch that's reliable. That's why you buy a watch. Something that's reliable. So I've still got, let's check how Sissy's doing. By the way, she seemed to have lost a couple of seconds recently, but only over a period of many days has she lost 2 seconds. And now she might have caught up again for all I know. So we've got 45, let's see, we're about 21 and 45, that's about 24 seconds different. 25, yeah, exactly 25 seconds actually, to be more precise. 30, oh, well, 25 or 26 seconds, so she's lost 3 or 4 seconds over that same period of time. So she's losing about a second every day or something currently, which is phenomenal, sensational. Excellent performance for a watch. And I love this watch because she's got the day of the week at the top. It really helps keep you oriented on what day it is of the month, too, if you know the day of the week. So, and of course, she's got also the day of the month is displayed at 3 o'clock also. It's very prominent. So, but today I'm wearing a watch that was very expensive, but it's made by a company that's a division of Seiko in Japan. It's the Orient Star Company, which is the sort of luxury brand of Seiko. Orient Star, it's an automatic watch. It has a wonderful feature of showing you the power of the watch at the top. So as the power winds down, the dial will move. But of course, if you're wearing it, the dial will not probably move because it's going to be wound all the time. It's automatic. It's automatic. It winds up by the rotor that rotates when you move your wrist around. But it's got that the power reserve indicator on it. And it's got a visibility, I forget what they call it. You can see inside the mechanism and see it moving. It's got a glass window right into the, in to see the balance wheel moving. So you can see the workings of the watch as it's ticking. You can see if it's working, although you'd know that. You'd know that because the second hand's moving. This is a beautiful color, too. This second hand is the same beautiful blue color that the Rolex Day-Date homages have, this dark blue, just beautiful blue. Not too dark. It's just a beautiful, beautiful royal blue of some kind. And the hand, the minute and the hour hands on the Orient Star. What do I call her? I call her Star, actually. She's called Star. And her hour and minute hands are also blue, outlined in blue. That same beautiful blue. And so is the, of course, power reserve indicator hand. It's also blue. But she's got a simple face on her because no numbers on the face. But she has a lunar indicator of the day of the lunar month. It's the bottom of the watch. There's a lunar indicator. Maybe I can show you, get it so you can see it. There you go. You're seeing that sort of this lunar shape, the shape of the moon as it goes into the, well, behind, it moves behind a screen. It moves behind the dial, and then as it becomes new moon, it disappears, of course, and then it comes out again. Well, actually, it's a different. It disappears behind the dial, and a duplicate image of it on the other side appears shortly thereafter in the following days. And alongside that, around the lunar day indicator, is a dial that indicates the day of the month, also that is a calendar day of the month. It goes up to 31 maximum. So you need to keep on these watches, when months have fewer than 31 days, you have to keep them adjusted for that. You have to make sure at the end of each month that they are keeping the proper day of the month. But they're automatically wound watches. Of course, a very expensive watch. Some of them, have more sophisticated ways of doing the days of the month, perhaps. There are such watches that can, but they're very expensive, that can keep track of, some number of years worth of calendar days, and you don't have to do anything. But just think what you have to do if it ever gets out of alignment, or if it's ever stops, the watch ever stops, what do you have to do, to get it back in alignment? If you have to wind through several years or something of time to get it lined up again with the correct calendar. So, yeah, these analog watches have their, or these mechanical, it's not just that they're analog, these mechanical watches, that's a very analog thing to have the moon moving. A moon shape moving and then becoming more like a crescent as it disappears behind the dial and so on. That's a very analog type of display, but it's more than an analog issue. These watches are not just analog, they're, more importantly, they're mechanical. And because that's why their accuracy is the way it is, which is not as good as the digital, based on the precise oscillation of a quartz crystal of an exact size. That's what quartz crystals are like. And the size of the quartz crystal, when it's subjected to a voltage, will vibrate at a very specific frequency. Electrically, that is. It's vibrating. I'm trying to think. It's an electromechanical vibration, I guess. Some kind of, come to think of it. But we never stop learning about these things, especially things like physics, science. We never stop learning more and more and more. There's always more to learn about this kind of thing. So, you should never worry about not knowing something, because you can always dive deeper into any matter of science, and you're never going to learn it all, no matter how deep you go. It's just infinitely deep. I never feel ashamed if I don't understand how these quartz crystals or some other aspect of science works, because I know from all of my science study how much there is to really learn, and how it's not a shameful thing, to not know something. Nobody knows everything except Jehovah. So just imagine how it would be to know everything. it's not something that's human, the ability to know everything. But if we thought about, what was I just thinking, this idea of, yeah, some people nowadays are talking about this theory that the world's like a video game, where in video games, you know, the answer's not generated unless you ask the question in a video game, you know, unless you choose that path. There's no generated answer or path. The path does not need to generate the answer unless you go down that path. So people are, in theoretical circles, talking about reality may not be entirely in existence, but only the part of reality that you're experiencing is the part that needs to be generated, and that may be generated on demand. So in other words, it's like, it reminds me of Schrodinger's box, where there's a dead cat or a live cat in the box, depending on whether the cat died or not. And until you open the box, you don't know if the cat is dead or alive. It's called the Schrodinger cat, I think, illustration, or the thought experiment about Schrodinger's cat. Is the cat dead or alive is the question. You don't know until you open the box. And this is the thing about quantum physics. It's one of the things about quantum physics, that is that you can't determine the state of any particle unless you measure it. It's not like we do with our eyes. When we see things with our eyes, we can just look at them, right? And we don't expect that they're going to change from when we look at them one moment to the next moment when we look back again after looking away somewhere else. We think they're going to stay more or less the same, unless we know that there's something that's, you know, a process happening, something changing. But we can just look at things and we don't expect them to change. Now, that's the same in theory, maybe, for any particles in subatomic physics, which is very small particles. But in those kinds of cases where quantum physics applies, such as those cases, and it does apply in those cases, quantum physics doesn't enable us to see those things because they're not emitting any light or reflecting any light. They're too small. They're beyond the macro world, and they're in the micro, the tiny nano world, where light is big compared to these particles, essentially. You know, it's just not able to be a useful way of investigating these things. So light is not the modus operandi here. Instead, we're using something like we have to bombard it with some other particle, like we have to shoot an electron at it or bounce something off it, like an electron, to see what's happening with it. We can't just shine light on it. So it's very difficult to know what's going on. But even in the case of electrons and what their orbital states are in atoms, for example, we can't know what orbital state the electron's in or what the spin of the electron is, any given electron, unless we measure it. And then when we know there's two electrons that are paired together, one is in a spin up and one spin down, if we separate the two from each other, I think then we can talk about what's called, I forget what it's called. What's it called? It's got the idea of synchronization, anyway, where there's the two states are linked together. There's a word. It's very obvious. I just forget what the word is. It's going to come to me perhaps right now, but it's true that two particles can be linked in a way such that when you know the state of one of them, the other one is determined, right? And as soon as that's the case, but you can't know the state of one without measuring it, right? But neither state is determined either. That's the other thing. We're coming back to this video and video game analogy, it's not necessary to generate the video until you're playing that part of the game, right? So it's the same thing with these electrons. We don't have to know what the state of each one is. And in fact, like until we need to know, we don't investigate and we don't know what state they're in, but also they don't even have a state. Is the theory, you know, that their state is not determined. It's the actual theory, the quantum theory. Until you measure it, the state's not determined. But if you know that they're both connected in this way, in this quantum way, where one is the opposite of the other, for example, that's one way that these two particles can be interconnected. One has to be the opposite of the other because they're paired. So if you separate them, or if you can determine what their relation is, any way at all, if you know that one is in one state and that the other one is in either the same or the opposite state, then measuring one of them automatically necessitates and determines what the other one is, because they're bound by that constraint that was this quantum constraint that's what's it called? It's so obvious. Let's look at, see if we can find it. What is the quantum determinism? It's quantum determinism or something, right? What's it called? There are a lot of questions in quantum physics, right? So anyway, this is one of the ideas that they talk about. It's not even known what state the particle's in, but as soon as you, or it's not even, the particle doesn't even know what state it's in until you measure it. It's kind of like the Schrodinger's cat idea. And once you measure it, that automatically determines not only its state, but the states of any other objects to which it is quantumly bound, right? That's it for today's study. It's November 19th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 22:31 hours, North American Eastern Time. Thank you so much for listening and watching once again. It's Ward Green. I love you very much. And on my behalf, this is Sissy and this is Star, saying bye for now. And that was Chapter 7, Paragraph 6 of the Arc of Urartu. And we just got a couple more seconds, but I went shopping today. Got some butter and some milk. Not some cream, but milk. Goat's milk. I'm very glad about that. And working on my nutrition these days, of course, and my heating. Got a new heater, just got delivered. It's a heat pump. Talk about it later.